Blog Talk Radio.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, check ignition, 1. And may God's love be with you. Now it's time.
see, 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 right. Oh, see what you have done. I said, see, 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 right. Oh, see what you have done. My girl, you made me love you. Now, 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 your loving man has gone. Hear what I say. Well, I'm going away, baby. And I won't be back till fall. And I'm going away, baby. And I won't be back till fall. Well, if I find me a good girl, I wanna go, I wanna be back at home. Hear what I say? I said, see, 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 right. Oh, see what you have done. I said, see, 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 right. Oh, see what you have done. Well, girl, you made me love you. No, 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 you look bad. Play it, man.
Tonight on John Talk Radio, my guest, my special guest, always special guest, John and David Timmons of Timmons Brothers, a look into Bowie and Presley, the Thin White Duke, and the King. John and David, are you there?
Thank you very much. How are you doing there, John?
Yes, Space Oddity and Space Odyssey 2001, what an opening. John, I like it.
If that doesn't get you going, guys, nothing will. That's just.
Well, I was ready to climb out of my tin can as soon as I heard Bowie. You know, like right off the bat there.
Oh, poor David. He's floating in a most peculiar way.
That's
way to link up the two tonight, along with their January 8th birthdays.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, when I was reading a little bit, guys, about the both of them and how that Mr. Bowie was influenced by Presley and listened to his father, brought the records home when he was a child and listened to them. And it's kind of cool. I wonder what Elvis Presley thought of David Bowie. I mean, I don't know. But tonight on John Talk Radio, we're going to explore it, guys. We're going to go into it from head to toe with John and David Timmons, and we're going to look into these two amazing artists that actually, in a lot of rock history, they'll both say that they changed the face of rock music at their time.
I tell you, John, one of the main things I can always remember the first time on Elvis, just like I always said, he was the father of rock and roll, but with Bowie, Bowie's influence of Elvis when he formed his first band, which had Peter Frampton in it with him too, and they were both in high school together. Then one of their first songs they did together was "Love Me Tender." And I always wondered what would it sound like with Bowie doing it when Frampton on guitar. It's
sort of
been interesting. That'd been tough.
Oh yeah, that'd be awesome. That's just it's hard. It's kind of amazing, guys, to look back at that and how a lot of these bands and these great artists got together and got started. But what we want to do tonight is look at the similarities between the two. And what did you guys find that were some of the basic similarities between David Bowie and Elvis Presley?
Both of them was on the RCA label, which is amazing. Both of them had that. And like I said, and then John can tell you about the main thing of his influence of me was always the RCA label.
I think one thing in finding the connection of the two, John, is Elvis was in the early stages of TV, and rock and roll was this new genre that people really didn't understand, that it was for the youth. They were rebellious, and to let someone perform on TV, still trying to figure out what is going to be the purpose of the TV, how will it change the culture of as far as the American people day-to-day living, and then have him in everyone that did have a TV in their living room, and bring this sort of rebellious, flamboyant youth to the screen. It was a pioneer, and Ed Sullivan is to be commended to take that risk and put Elvis on there. And now, everybody remembers the second appearance when he had the shot from the waist up only, but it was the first appearance that really showed that all as far as the sensuality of Elvis. I mean, it was... for that period, it was a very a time that was really conservative. You got to remember the same era when it was the Everly Brothers making "Wake Up, Little Susie," and it was banned from many radio stations because it was about a boy and a girl being overnight in a drive-in theater.
Yeah, I think Elvis shook them all up too there when he came on stage there too.
And then with Bowie, if we fast forward, he became famous sort of word of mouth because TV by that time in the early 70s started to turn its back on rock and roll. There was no longer the outlet for the variety show of an Ed Sullivan show, of a Smother Brothers, of a Red Skelton, Hollywood Palace. And so for David Bowie being really colorful in the stage props and everything, it was like word of mouth, and you'd read about it in magazines.
Yeah, Cream Magazine and Circus and the FM radio, and you had to listen to FM radio after they got done with everything else. And with Bowie, and like John said, a comparison, but with Bowie, I had to fight what I call the dark eras, as John and I call it, of rock and roll, and where Elvis got the limelight of the rock and roll. But Bowie's Space Oddity, which was his first American single, and he turned down a chance to be on American Bandstand because he didn't think he would really be that big of a star in the States. So that's what makes it so interesting.
So, do you guys think that with David Bowie's music, and I don't know a whole lot about his first release. I know, was it Space Oddity, his second album release?
Yes.
And what was his first one like, David? I mean, what was...
The first album was a mixture of songs that was produced in 1967, and it was about his coat. It's called The Coat, which was a single that he had made, and also he made one called the Gnome, the Gnome song, which it was very unknown on the London label, and he basically came out of nowhere, and he was basically into the Yardbirds at the time, and Rolling Stones and the Kinks, and he would listen to all their songs, and slowly he got developing his songs, but his first album he made even in England on the Decca label, I don't even think it charted. Am I right on that, John?
Right. It did not. And here's something that only Dave and I and other people that are avid fans of Paul Revere and the Raiders would know. He recorded a Lindsey Revere-written tune, Louie Go Back Home, or Louie Come Back Home, which was from the Raiders album The Midnight Ride.
Wow.
And I find that really ironic. So Bowie, in 1966, is being influenced by Paul Revere and the Raiders.
He should be in the Hall of Fame.
To the point he records that song on his earliest album. And that would be re-released years later, though, as a two-album set after he became famous. They compiled a lot of his Decca music. And a lot of it, though, is kind of folksy in many ways.
Very Bob Dylan-ish, I'd call it.
A lot of acoustic.
Anthony Newley.
Sort of, the album, which was Space Oddity was a lot like that, though, too. You know, which was early Bowie.
Right. I read where he was having, making a decision whether to do the rock band thing, you know, to go out with a full band or just go on with an acoustic and sing and play like that in his early stages of his career.
It was Mick Ronson, though, that convinced Bowie, very great guitar player in his own right, that convinced Bowie. Bowie wanted to go out on a stool with acoustic guitar, but Mick Ronson convinced him he needed a band. And so Mick Ronson formed the Spiders from Mars, the Bees backup band at the time, which you would hear on the Man Who Sold the World album. Basically, that's when they put that all together.
Was that David's third album, or was that the fourth one?
John, I believe, am I right on this, John? Was that the third album?
For the Man Who Sold the World?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
I'd have to look for sure, but I think it was the third one because it got re-released underneath a different album cover.
Yeah, and it was on two labels.
In America, because the original album cover was sort of a cartoonish, right? It was some kind of cartoon strip.
Yeah, it had like little comic strips basically on it. And then the other one, got released in the United States, I believe, in early 72, and had him doing his famous Bowie leg kick. And which
it was a black and white cover.
Yes, and I believe he had a mixture of songs there that was very strange, though. Some of them were very dark. Most of them songs were on that, I thought.
Well, that's part of the what we want to look at tonight, because his songwriting, it, from what I can see, guys, was very innovative and did knock down barriers, because there was a things that I remember listening to David Bowie songs and Ziggy Stardust album and things like that. Great pop music, great rock music, but the lyrics were a little different, and I thought he pushed the envelope a little bit there. I think you guys, what do you think of that?
I think one song from the man who sold the world is called Black Country Rock. He mixed the mixture of soul with country, and I have never heard another song like this. And it's not a big song; it's just an album cut. But when you listen to this, you could always tell he knew how to use the studio and knew how to produce himself. Because it, like I said, it make the country artist wonder where this guy come from. You know, it's really that strange of a song, and mixture of both.
It is interesting you'd mention that one, David, because some critics, believe it or not, rank that as one of his best songs he made, the song you just mentioned. I mean, not for popularity, but as far as quality and being sort of the trailblazer that it was. I mean, to connect black and country in 1970, you know, I mean, who was thinking about doing that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was very ahead of its time. And maybe that's why it did not do much as far as any type of commercial sales. But looking back on it now, it's probably one of his more, as far as the critically acclaimed.
Now, was his music at that point, let's say like in 1970, was he selling a lot of records in England at that time, or just not in the States?
He was already, John, appearing on Top of the Pops in England, but he had not got the recognition. Now, the albums were over here, but not too many people were buying them, but he would appear on Top of the Pops and do some of the songs from his 70s stuff. I've seen a clip from a BBC show where he was on the show one night, the same night when the Animals was on there, and I can't remember the other act was on there, but Bowie came out, and he also did, like I said, they did the song Black Country Rock. But he was already big in Europe, but not making that big stepping stone to the groundbreaking album of Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting too, because we want to talk about that and how that we compare that with Elvis's career. Now let's take a look at Mr. Elvis Presley's career and his very humble beginnings. What were his first? I think Hound Dog wasn't it? What was his first releases, but they were all of his releases big, or did it take Elvis a while to get to get started and going also. Is there a comparison there between his career at the beginning and Bowie's?
Yeah, I think there is, John. With Elvis, you know, he might have rose quicker, I mean, as far as compared to Bowie, but, you know, he was doing more like in the South. He was probably well known at, like even as early as 52, 53, and was sort of a hidden secret. Strangely enough, I'm not sure how many people at that era when Hound Dog was released really knew he was taking a song that had already been recorded and sort of made it so it was for more of a commercial wide audience, and it took off. But, you know, some of his music was, of course, right into the Southern gospel blues. And he just, it was like something that some the radio stations were kind of reluctant, I think, because they still were trying to understand, what is this rock and roll? Is it rock and roll? Had that phrase even been coined yet? You know,
John, you brought up a good point here. He appeared down in New Orleans. There was a radio show called Country Hayride. Well, Roy Acuff was the host of that night. They have not heard what Elvis do. They had took him for a country artist. He comes out there shaking and everything, and I bet Minnie Pearl's hat came off. but he does perform at the Hayride. I've read this in a biography about Elvis, and he opens up with a Hound Dog, and he also does a song called Milk Cow Blues. But you got to figure, here's a man that's going to innovate rock, and here he is playing at a country stage. You just got to imagine how they all felt at that show at night. And this was in 19, I believe, late 52, early 53, because Hank Williams was on the show at night because Hank was still alive. So it had to be around that time period.
But what was the first recording that Elvis, I mean, not necessarily a hit recording, but just the first time that he recorded his music? Do you guys know what that was?
I think, John, I think it was with Sun Records, and I think he had to pay for his studio time, and he made a couple songs, and the idea was it was to be like a present for his mother. However, if I remember this correctly, somehow Sam Phillips gets word of this demo he did for his mother, and you know,
Jerry Lee Lewis tells Sam Phillips about him, John,
and he wants them to get in touch with this person, right? Mm-hmm. Dave, is that how it was? Like, find out where this guy
come from?
Having come back,
yes.
You know, and what's funny, in the meantime, here's Elvis. He wants to join in a local group. It was a vocal group, and they were called the Songfellows, and he failed the audition.
Oh my God.
And he said to his dad when he got there, he goes, They told me I couldn't sing.
They told me, and he thought he'd have to go back driving the garbage truck in Memphis.
Right, right.
Yeah. See, he was originally a garbage truck driver, and he thought this was all it. But then Sam Phillips caught wind of that recording for his mother, and he played that for all the Jerry. He already had Jerry Lee Lewis in his stable at that time playing, and also I believe Carl Perkins. And they both heard that, and once they heard that, they said, "You got to find this Presley kid," didn't they, John?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, what is funny about that too, John, is can you imagine being the one who told Elvis to this local audition, "Boy, you're a good guy and all, but you just can't sing." He'd be right there with the guy at Decca Records in 1962 that told Brian Epstein, "That group will never make it." Guitar bands on the way out, take your Beatles elsewhere.
Yeah. Oh, there's always those guys, aren't there?
There were your guys that disappear in history quick.
The naysayers, but they're,
yeah,
always,
yeah. Yeah,
they're out there. But how old was Elvis, guys, when that happened, when he recorded in Sun Studios for his mother? What age was Elvis?
He was young. He was like 18.
Yeah, he'd barely
this
turned
18. This was 1953,
yeah,
and he would
yeah.
have been born 35. Yeah, so he was 18.
He had barely turned 18, yes. So he was just a big kid.
And then at that point, then he, you said Sam Phillips. What happened then, guys? Did Sam Phillips then contact the family and say, I need this guy back in the studio at that point?
He personally sent a telegram to the house. And
oh.
you, back then, when you got a telegram, you always thought it was bad news back that time period. And
yep.
they said his mother almost passed out, so they need him immediately to come to the Sun's studios. We want to meet this young man. And so I can just imagine the Presley house at that time, all them rushing around and stuff. That had to be something.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Also, Sam Phillips was seeing dollar signs because he had been searching for a white performer who could take the sound yeah. of the black music to a broader white audience. And here was Elvis. Some people thought he was black even, you know, with his vocal. And he was quoted as saying, if I can find a white man who has the black sound, the black feel, I could make $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, that's when he does the demo for Sam Phillips. And then he brings in the, you know, some of the band performers that would later, like, you know, you've got Scotty Moore, who was with Elvis, you know, for
Johnny
a while.
Cash. Johnny
yeah.
Cash would play sing backup for Elvis Presley. A lot of people don't know that. And I could see Johnny Cash walk in there and go, who's this guy? You know, like that. And he'd walk in there. But there was Johnny Cash at the time. He had a big stable, Carl Perkins, Roy Orbison. I always thought to me, if Sam Phillips knew what he had at Sun Studio, which he didn't realize at the time, that man would have been, well, he was a millionaire, but imagine if you'd have put all them in one super group.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting, too, when you guys talk about Sam Phillips and saying, you know, I want to get this kid that can be more marketable, you know, to the broader white audience. And that kind of makes me think of the record industry and the promoters and the kind of the good and the bad of that. You know, you've got the, you know, I want to make this kid a star. I'm going to do that. But what's that going to cost? You know, what's that going to do to Elvis? What's that going to do to this kid in Mississippi that, you know, loves to sing and loves music? And what did that do to this guy? You know what I mean? And that's interesting, too, with David Bowie. I mean, they work really, really hard to get to the top of their industry. And there's no problem with that because that's how, you know, when people are talented and they work hard, that's great. But I also think it's interesting, guys, how the record company can take that talent, that music talent, like we're talking about songwriting talent, that pure magical talent, and just start tapping it for, you know, they can get out of it. Yeah.
Hey, John, you hit something on the head there, which is very true in the music industry. They can, the labels, I've talked a lot, when I met a couple members, it was originally in the McCoys, and you step into this world, here's Elvis and Bowie, they know their songwriters and everything, they take advantage of them right off away. We say, well, you write us some songs, but they don't tell them there's, when you sign on that dotted line, so, some people call it like selling your soul to the record industry,
yeah.
which really you do, and a lot of young artists don't write, but like I say this for Bowie over Elvis, Bowie formed his own company called Main Man, where Elvis was controlled by Colonel Parker and Sam Phillips. Bowie was smart enough. He was very intelligent this way. He formed his group Main Man when he walked into the RCA wanted originally signing. He brought in that, and he said, I got to do it my way or no way. And at that time period, you're saying in the early 70s, to have that kind of courage when he was with Decca, which failed, but Bowie had so much faith in his songwriting, he was willing to do this. And sometimes he was one of the few artists I know that stepped up to the plate and did that, where Elvis was kind of not sure about, because it was a new world to him, but the Bowie had already made up his mind. And, John, you probably agree with that, don't you?
Yeah, I do. You know, John, your guest last week Randy, help me out.
Randy Holden?
Yeah, Randy Holden. He made a good point that relates to tonight's show, how corporate changed Elvis. And,
yeah.
You know, Elvis was this rebellious rock and roller of the 50s that some years later would have greats like John Lennon and Cliff Richard saying, without Elvis, there would not be a John Lennon. The Beatles, without Elvis, there would not be a Cliff Richard.
Right.
And, you know, it was like the military. I like to consider that the benchmark that changed the career for Elvis in the way his career took a major change from not touring to doing all these movies that were...
Colonel Parker had a lot to do with that, too.
And that's where I'm going with that, too,
yes.
is the influence of Colonel Parker, whereas Bowie, I think, learned from these kind of things, saw what happened to some past artists, and took more control, but not at a major risk. For instance, he was already well-known by 1973-74, but it has been shown years later, he was putting out his own money to have these big tours with the yard, with the large props and the special kind of stage show and effects. He was putting out his own money and was nearly bankrupt, and it was fortunate for him that it was the David Live album and Young Americans that really put him on the upside to start making a profit. But he was still selling out concerts, but at what cost? He was doing it on his own expense.
The Ziggy Stardust stage alone cost $850,000 back to set up back in early late 72, early. And you got to remember, $850,000 back then probably have been equivalent now, I believe, a couple million now.
You could see a major concert for $5 in 1972.
And he was putting out that kind of money.
Yeah, that's a really good point about Bowie. And you can. It's a really good point about the controlling your own destiny and your own music, because it would be easy to say to the record company, okay, take it, you know, give me this money. You supply all my everything I need. You take care of the stages. You take care of everything. But at what cost do you do that? That's a really interesting thing in music right now, because there's probably a lot of bands that start off with all this really incredibly original stuff. And then when the record company starts poking around at it, thinking, you know, you guys need to sound a little bit more like Justin Bieber. Or
wouldn't that be scary?
Or, you know, can you sound more like that? And I think it's interesting. I didn't know this about Bowie, how he financed some of his own things. But that would show his confidence that I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make my music. And also, we talked before, guys, and on some of our previous shows about the visual and you know, the music and how that Bowie was really interested in people seeing things as they're hearing things. And using both senses as that.
The one thing I would say on this about Bowie, John, when he put on a show, and I can quote it best in the song that Mott the Hoople made, it's the sight before the sound, in which he did do. He would have such a stage show, and when most people, because I even heard Madonna in an interview one time, her biggest influence for what her stage show is now was watching David Bowie as a little girl.
Now,
so that tells you a lot right there, when what she does on stage now. And when he came out, I know John and I saw the film Ziggy Stardust at a movie theater one time. And he, when he prepared, it showed him backstage, he would prepare, wouldn't he, John, for a half an hour to an hour to know what he wanted to do out there with his band.
Oh, that's great. But I want to say something. I have, this is going to be like You Bet Your Life tonight with the magic word, because I had a magic word that I put out on my website that if David Timmons would say this magic word, I would play this song. And you said the magic word, David, which was Mott the Hoople. So we're going to take a music break, and this one is for David. And we'll be back with the rest of the interview with a discussion on the Timmons Brothers right after this song.
All right, you're not too old for a sing-along, are you? Yeah, well, let's see.
Here's Thank you very much. Way back in a long time ago, we did this album with this song on. I blanked. I don't know the album. I don't know the year.
Did you guys catch that? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, they did the same as Elvis. Hey, John, there's a story behind all the young dudes. Bowie was producing Mott the Hoople. Bowie gave Ian Hunter and Mick Rouse a choice of two songs. They said you could either do Drive-In Saturday or All the Young Dudes. Well, Ian Hunter says, no way we're going to do Drive-In Saturday. You either give us All the Young Dudes or we're walking out of the studio. And Bowie had to give him into the song. And Bowie knew it would have been a hit single for him, but he had so much creation aid for that band. It should be in the Hall of Fame, too. But for Mott the Hoople to give him that recognition. And then that's the story behind that. I read about that in Ian Hunter's biography where him and Bowie, but if they had done the other song, I don't think it would have clicked.
You know, that is such an awesome song. I mean, every time I hear that, whether I'm in the radio or on the radio, in the car listening to the radio, it's just, and listening to it right now tonight, it's got so much energy to the song, and it's just a great sing-along. And I there's some stuff out there, guys, like on Wembley Stadium and where he's done with all these people out there singing it. It's just a great song. It just gives me goosebumps when I hear that song. But I thought it was pretty cool to have that thank you very much in there with the Elvis part. But
it really is. And, you know, All the Young Dudes, I'd have to put it in this category that I like to call what are the anthems of rock what's our sing-along songs, you want to wave back and forth, that would be in that category. And it's pretty elite to make that kind of well-known, where the whole audience, thousands and thousands, are like singing it right along with the performer.
And we do have a caller, area code 910. Do you have a question or a comment for David and John?
Yeah, I've got a question for John. He may know me, Fig Moses.
Hey, how you doing, Fig?
Good, how are you doing, bud?
Good, good.
Just got in from a ball game, so I wanted to call and ask him questions.
Good, good.
You know, they say John Lennon played with Bowie on Fame. Was he a backup singer, or how did his voice come in to the song?
Now, Fig, here's what I know about it, and I'll let Dave, you know, he might have more on it, but I do know he helped write the song, Fame.
Okay.
I know that...
He played guitar on it, too, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And John Lennon, and John can... I'm pretty sure on this, and John Lennon... Bowie talked to John Lennon. This time Bowie was kind of struggling a little bit at this time. John Lennon and him co-wrote this song, and John Lennon does sing backup vocals and plays guitar on this. So you got a super pair there.
I'm telling you.
Wow, that's great.
And you know, that was a time when Bowie, too, Fig, you know, was fighting drug abuse. He was having problems with cocaine and heroin, and Lennon helped getting back on the right track for a little bit there, but it wasn't really until he goes to Berlin and pairs up with Iggy Pop, they kind of helped each other get out of their abysmal state they were in.
But too, John, this was what really charted Bowie for the new direction he was going to, too, and this was what got his life straightened up. Because when this song shot up the charts, it was really something, and especially to have one of the Beatles on your song, it had really help.
That can't hurt.
That's right, you can't hurt. And Fig brings up a good point. I cannot find any accounts on what that was like when Lennon and Bowie. How did they meet? How did they decide to write a song
Harry
together?
Nilsson. It was Harry Nilsson.
So he was the one that had them connected. Okay.
Well, they was all in RCA. Harry Nilsson had John Lennon and the RCA Studios. They was making this album, Owl and the Pussycat.
That's right.
They was making this album, and John Lennon caught wind of Bowie in the next studio and liked what he heard. And he asked Harry Nilsson, who's got, oh, he said it's some glam guy named Bowie. And John Lennon wanted to meet him. And after that, John Lennon was surprisingly songwriting.
Wow.
Fig, you can tell the story here. Tell us about your nickname you had when you were working at the Bob Evans there. Because he goes by Fig, but it goes with tonight's show with David Bowie.
Well, that one guy started calling me Figgy Stardust.
Oh, that's great.
It's an old high school nickname, Fig Newton, but it's to this day, I'll drive back with John and go to town and everybody's Fig Moses.
Next time I come to Winford, Fig, I'll have to meet you on the tour.
Sounds good.
Fig, take care.
Do you have any other questions for him, Fig? Or?
That's it. I just wanted to say hey and thanks for the answer.
Well, it's great having you call in. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I'll talk to you later, John.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. So that's pretty cool. Figgy Stardust, I'll never forget that.
I'll be wanting to eat a Fig Newton now when I'm listening to Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, that's good. I'm a little hungry anyway, so.
Yeah. John, if I can go back to Dave told the story about all the young dudes and how Bowie had already written the song and was willing to give that up. And since tonight we are connecting Elvis Presley with David Bowie, and here's a story that's been told to me from a Elvis fanatic, and he knows Elvis well, and so I will take it that hearing from him, it's a good resource. Elvis had the opportunity to record Blue Suede Shoes, even though Carl Perkins, had written and so on, and they wanted Elvis to sing it because, you know, Elvis was already well known. His hits were just one after another. And Elvis and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but pretty much said, hey, Carl Perkins wrote that. He's the one that deserves to have a hit of it. Release
That's
a single, release the one he made. Don't release mine. And lo and behold, becomes a huge hit for Carl Perkins. But that's the kind of guy Elvis Presley was. You know, he gave up that song because someone else had written it, and he liked the way they did it, and they wrote it, and said, no, he's the one that should have all the profits and so on that would go along with that tune.
And Carl Perkins was his only number one single he ever had, and that's pretty generous to give up a number one single.
Well, that's interesting too, guys, because I think that, you know, a lot of people maybe don't know that side of Elvis. You know, when you get to be that huge of a star, you know, you think of all the things that he did and the excess and all that. But that's really a good story to hear that, because I think that sometimes the media would rather hear the bad stuff or that, but they won't put the emphasis, you know, on some of the good things that these guys have done and what Elvis did.
I got a story about Bowie now. Uh-huh. Bowie had heard about Mark Bolan and T-Rex. John, now my brother John knows where I'm going at with this one. Mark Bolan was already a big glam star before Bowie got started. Well, Mark Bolan caught wind and he wanted to record with Bowie. They go into the studio that day. They worked on one song. I believe Bowie was working on Pinups, so I'm right on this, ain't I, John?
Yes.
Now, Pinups. Well, Mark Bolan plays his guitar on Sorrow. Well, he plays his guitar on Sorrow, and Bowie and Mark did not hit it off. He had different philosophies of what they wanted to do in the studio, and they would not make up and talk to each other for their musical differences until, was it 2 weeks before Mark Bolan gets killed in the car wreck? And they were going to make an album, and I always said, what if that album would have came out? It would have been Jim Gannis. We'll never know. But musical differences, though, even Bowie would have conflicts with Bolan. Bolan wanted to be more electrified. Bowie wanted to make it more sound musical strings and stuff. And so between the two of them, sometimes you have conflict with two major artists. And it was been interesting what would have been, though.
Oh, that's a really good point, because there's a lot of that, you know, the artistic freedom and people, especially in the studio. But I think, guys, let's take another music break. We got a lot of good music to play tonight, and let's play a couple songs, and one by Elvis and one by Bowie, and then we can talk about those when we come back. But this is John Talk Radio. We've got a little extended tonight. We're going to go on an extra half hour tonight because I just felt like this would probably do that. We had so much to talk about and great music to play. My guests are John and David Timmons, a look into Bowie and Presley, the Thin White Duke and the King. And then you want to know more about John and David, go out on timmonsrock.com and check out what they're doing and the really cool stuff that's going on there. And We here at John Talk Radio have some really cool stuff going on, and then this 2012, it looks really good so far. So we just want to thank everybody that's listened and supported the Timmons Brothers and John Talk Radio. And we're going to play Jailhouse Rock and Hang On to Yourself in back to back. And anything you want to say before that, or do you just want me to play them and
We'll go ahead and play them, John, then we'll describe them for you then.
Okay.
I kind of want to dance in the jailhouse right now.
All right. This is John Talk Radio. We're going to play Elvis Presley, Jailhouse Rock, and we'll be right back after these songs.
Purple gang, let's rock. Everybody, let's rock. Everybody. me. Come on and do the jail hot rock with me. Let it rock. Everybody let it rock. Everybody get on the cell block.
January 21st, my guests are John and David Timmons, a look into Bowie and Presley. We just played Jailhouse Rock and Hang On to Yourself. That's some pretty good music there, guys.
Hey, John, there's one thing that you catch on the guitar licks on Jailhouse Rock. If you listen to the early Beatles, them guitar chords are basically, and my brother John agreed with this, don't that sound like John Meet the Beatles, a lot of the guitar work?
Oh, I thought this. I swear, I thought the same thing when I was listening to it. Right now,
it very heavily influenced them.
Oh yeah, it's really cool to listen to that because, you know, sometimes you have to. You can listen to music in all sorts of ways, but it's kind of cool sometimes to just take it easy and just listen. You know, to what the recording was and what was going on, and both of those were like Gosh, so much energy in both of those songs.
Here's a story I can tell you about Jailhouse Rock it's amazing with its influence. It was in the early 80s. When I was a graduate assistant at Miami University, we were having a dance, and they had the DJ. And at this time, the popularity of the Stray Cats was really big. They were playing
right.
the Stray Cats stuff, and She's Sexy, and 17, a couple other songs like that that brought back that kind of the rockabilly music. And so I snuck into the DJ and said, here, put this on in the middle of them. We didn't play Jailhouse Rock, and people just kept dancing just like it was another Stray Cat song in 1982, And I was like, folks, that was Elvis, And it was funny to think, here I was fitting in a song that at that point is already 25 years old, and people were like, hey, this is fresh,
That song does not age. Then on Hang On To Yourself, John, this is when we was in Razor's Edge. That was one of the first songs that we had to do was Hang On To Yourself. Not as good as Bowie. I think the neighbors probably didn't think so either. But we sure gave it a shot, didn't we, John?
Well, the reason I asked you to get this song, because that was probably my first favorite song by David Bowie, was Hang On To Yourself, and I thought it should have been a huge hit. I mean, it's just such a good song, kind of got sort of an Eddie Cochran feel to it, but yet at the same time, with that little guitar there, and at the same time, it kind of like sort of a combination of rock pop, but kind of a preview of punk that is going to unfold 4 or 5 years later.
The Clash mentioned that in their interview. The Clash, listen to that song, you hear the early influence of punk. And then also, that was a Bowie Ronson written song, and that was the flip side of Starman. It was the B-side of Starman over in England on the single. How it didn't get much airplay, Starman ended up being, I believe it charted number 4 in Europe. And everybody, but Hang On Yourself, John, I think it did chart even in Europe up to number 40, even as a B-side, which is something.
Yeah.
How did that do in the U.S.? I remember it being I remember a lot of that guys from playing it on the album, but I don't remember how it did on the charts or anything.
John, and I believe my brother John can correct me on this. I think it charted on Billboard, but John, did it get any further, John, in around 58 or 59?
I'm not sure if he even got that high.
I don't think it for some reason it didn't.
Because, again, like Bowie was this hidden secret, unless you really had a very good album-oriented rock station, nobody was playing David Bowie. And if they were, you didn't know who he was. But you didn't have no idea who this artist was.
You remember, John, we had to get in WTUE out of Dayton, Ohio, on FM to listen to a lot of rock and roll.
Right.
And, especially of Bowie and all them. Because I can remember the day I bought the 8-track tape of Ziggy Stardust, and Dad says, look at this cover. It's one strange character. Remember, he said, John. So I stick in the 8-track tape. My dad had an 8-track tape player, and we had one in the truck, and I had a portable one in the house. Well, Dad sat down, and Dad and Mom was always fair about our music. Dad listened to that, and he said, I don't know about his singing voice, but somebody can really pick guitar. He always loved to hear guitars. And then he said, this guy with a blue and red eye has to be in some other world.
And he probably was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, John, I think we actually told this story when we did our glam rock show, but I think it needs to be given again. Bowie was such a, and again I'll use the word like a hidden secret. David and I, at least I did, I discovered Bowie when our friend Jesse Frisbee shows us, he's cutting pictures out of rock magazines, and we're looking through his scrapbook and turn this one page, and it's like, who is this unusual looking dude with the spike red hair and the two different eyes, two different eye collars? And then we look at David, and we thought, is it Bowie? Who is this guy? Well, it was as far as our being really sort of curious, Dave says, I'm going to go out and buy something by him. We have not heard a song by him. David goes to the department store, I think the Time Buckeye Mart. You got the 8-track tape of The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust. And I even said to Dave, I said, you're going to pay, what, $4.99 for an album?
$4.99, I paid the full amount.
that you probably will hear a guy that sounds like Tiny Tim doing Tiptoe Through the Tulips, you know? Because we have no idea what he sounds
that's
like
true,
other than he looked really weird and unusual in this picture.
Oh,
and so Dave
funny.
Puts it in, and I'm all set to start laughing. Well, the first song it plays, I'm like, okay, that's actually pretty good. It was Starman.
Oh,
in fact, I said, and now I'd find us out later, his real name was David Jones. And before I even knew this, I said, we're listening to Starman. I said, Dave, this singer sounds like Davy Jones of the Monkees in this particular song, Starman. And lo and behold, I found out later that David Bowie's real name was David Jones. That was just too weird. But as we kept listening,
couldn't you see the Monkees make ZZ Stardust?
See? Yep, you know, so that'll make Marcy happy. I got the Monkees mentioned.
I'll have to play the Monkees every time we mention that next
exactly,
year.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it'll be like the magic word.
Yep.
And John, as we kept listening to this 8-track tape, I was like, this is actually a good album. I like it.
We wear out the 8-track tape, don't we, John?
And by the time I got the song Hang On To Yourself, I was like, why isn't this song released as a single? This is just, to me, it just should have been a hit.
Well, there wasn't one, and you can't say that for too many albums, there wasn't one bad song on that whole tape. And there's not too many groups you can say that for. And you got to either be a Beatle or a Stone or a Bowie where to make albums like that, because normally if you bought an album, there's always going to be three songs you don't want to hear. But when you can enjoy that album, that is amazing. Because I can remember coming to my house and my older brother, I stuck it in there, and he said, I don't want to hear that space age rock and roll again. I said, but he was into Bobby Goldsboro and stuff. And I said, well, this is what I call space age rock and roll.
Do you think, guys, that also, like, you made some really good points, because, you know, you were you bought that, David, on faith that it was going to be good, and you're thinking, man, this is different. You know, I wanted to hear something different. Do you think that it was a good thing or a bad thing with Bowie's appearance and trying to break into the American music scene that, you know, like you said, that there wasn't that much publicity, people didn't know about it, he wasn't on the top 40, and people would hear it, and they would look at, like, the album cover and the different things and think, oh, my gosh, this guy's really out there. Do you think that was a positive or a negative thing for David?
I believe, John, in some ways it did hurt him, but if he was a real rock and roll fan like you are and John and I are, we know there would be negatives, but the best thing we thought was the music would speak for itself. Well, when Bowie first came to the United States, his warm-up act was Queen. Queen had just got started, and this is what Freddie Mercury said about him and Brian May. They said, this man is magical on stage, and eventually the audience came to him, but he didn't have the help of the TV station. It was actually the music fans that brought, I believe my brother John agreed with me, that brought Bowie to his career. Don't you think so, John?
Yeah, I think, you know, I feel you can make the argument that the outlandish look and the appearance and that he held his color, it drew attention to him. And in some ways, I feel it was a good move because he was in that era, the early 70s. If you didn't have a hit, radio stations were not going to play you. And that's how he caught our interest, was these pictures in magazines looking so different and so colorful compared to, you know, your singers that are usually just going to stand on stage and perform. And then he really changed the whole live concert as far as the industry. He made it so you had to elevate what you're going to do in concert and not just show up and play your instruments. You better have a show so you get the sound and the vision.
Well, Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons gave him the best compliment. He said, if David Bowie had not broke the barrier with Ziggy Stardust, there would have been no Kiss, because he was already doing the makeup and stuff. And Alice Cooper gives him credit for that. Somebody had to break that barrier, and it was Bowie that did this. And I believe to this day there wouldn't have been no Kiss or Alice Cooper.
But then again, if you watch Bowie, there's a lot of Little Richard influences on David Bowie. And if you want to go back that far, I think, on that part. But like I said, he had to break a barrier there. And like I said, then I couldn't have rock and roll all night with Kiss if it hadn't been for Bowie.
Well, you know, that's a good point, too, because you're talking about Bowie's stage show and how that changed things. Well, I guess our other person we're talking about kind of had the same thing. I mean, Elvis was known for his stage show that would just blow people away. And it was
absolutely.
Yeah,
all the energy he would give on a stage, you know, people were just sort of like, "What is this?" They were so taken aback. Someone would move, his hips would gyrate around, and he was doing big as far as big crowds at fairs and so on. And in many ways, you know, we always think of the Beatles for the concert when they did at the Shea Stadium. But Elvis probably was the one that took the rock sound out of a little gym and took it outdoors where they started having so more people could see him. I'm not saying 50,000, but he really was the trailblazer that opened up the door for the Beatles to do the big, as far as a stadium concert.
Yeah, and there's always that conversation around the sound quality of that because, you know, the Beatles weren't happy with the sound quality they were getting. Just think what Elvis was probably getting back in his early outdoor concerts because
he only had two Vox amps, and which couldn't have put out too much sound. But then again, the screaming and stuff for Elvis, though, and everything. Well, I read this one thing. It was an article. The girls would come there, and the mothers would have to bring smelling salts with them because they knew their daughters would pass out when he started shaking his hips. About the same thing like I do on stage. They would pass out probably.
Yeah, that might happen. But I think that it's how things progressed, and it's really cool, guys, how that the two – where you wouldn't think about putting them together in a show, but you guys did a good job in picking this because it just their music to me is like very high energy, and even when you talk about when they slow down and we're going to play maybe some slower songs here, but it's still emotional music, and they were both incredible trailblazers in rock and roll.
The key thing I'm between the two of them, John, and I will bring this up. Bowie and Elvis both made movies. Elvis had a better movie career than Bowie. Bowie made three movies. One was called Man Who Fell the Earth, and then he appears on the Doctor Who series over in England all the time as a Martian alien. And he's always trying to conquer Doctor Who, and only Bowie could get this character across. And also, I brought this up to one of your guests. He's also a speaker for King Neptune, all the SpongeBob series.
Oh, yeah. And wasn't he like some kind of, what was it, in another fantasy movie where he was some kind of
creature?
It was a labyrinth.
Yeah. That was great. I like that.
You know, he can take a character and he can turn into these characters, which is amazing to me. Well, one of the things which didn't happen, and it may happen yet, he has read the script to play the Mad Hatter in the next Batman movie, which is a possibility. So couldn't you see Ziggy Stardust battle Batman? That'd be interesting.
That would be. Yeah, I'd go into that.
Yeah,
that's cool. So I think we'll take another music break because I want to get some of this good music in. Because what happens a lot of times is the most we get hits on this show is in the podcast form, and we like to just put in the history and the music so people can, you know, listen to it all in one nice package. So let's my next set of songs is Hound Dog and Blue Jean, and we'll want to play those two, and also. When we come back, we'll comment on those two songs. But anything, guys, you want to say before we start off with those two?
Blue Jeans made a lot of money for Bowie with the Levi Company. It's all say.
Okay, you're listening to John Talk Radio with John and David Timmons, looking to Bowie and Presley. We're going to play a couple of songs. We'll be back after this with the rest of the show, so stick around.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Glass, but that was just a lie.
listening to John Talk Radio tonight, January 21st show with John and David Timmons. I'll look into Bowie and Presley. You know, guys, I think I might be losing my mind, but I thought I heard the Jordanaires in the background there on Blue Jean. That sounded like the Jordanaires were back there singing right along with David.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, John, I know, because we just played Hang On to Yourself, but again, in that Bowie song, you hear the inspiration of an Eddie Cochran sound.
Yeah.
It wasn't complex, just kind of straightforward, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of Ader and blues guitar work too in that, and which he was influenced that.
Yeah, that was awesome. Just to hear those two songs back to back, I would never think that they would fit together like that as well as they did.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, again, there was that kind of a connection. Bowie has a way of infusing so many styles of music, yet making it his own. And, you know, just like he's changed in appearance, his music can take such a dramatic turn as well. And he's always on the edge of being so creative, and ahead of what others are doing.
One thing Bowie was not afraid to do, and I heard people say that, he joined the band 1010, but he did not want to be the lead singer. I want to be a guitar player. And I had a friend that went and seen Iggy Pop one time, and he went to see Iggy Pop because he heard Bowie was going to be with him. It's the only thing Bowie did was play guitar and did backup vocals, he said. And who else would be a major star and be willing to do this? It's just amazing that, and he didn't want know the credit, did he, John?
Right. He just wanted to be a member of the band.
Now, that's awesome. I mean, that's really cool. And I was thinking about that, how their careers, it would be interesting. I mean, I wouldn't know what it would be like, what their actual personalities were like off stage and how they were with the people around them, because you hear so much about, you know, Elvis, and I don't hear a lot about David Bowie, his personal, you know, demeanor and things like that. I mean, it's just basically wrapped around his music and his acting career and things like that. But I wonder if their characters were similar.
Well, Elvis, I think this is one thing I think had hurt Elvis, where Bowie was more in private thing. Elvis let his first group to actually have a posse, I would say. He had Red West with him, Fontana, and all these guys. And Elvis had this group. If they wanted to rent out amusement park, they'd go and rent out amusement park or do this and that. Where if Bowie was more or less, he would, his music, and always changing what the music was. He was never going to be trapped in one era, because that's just the way Bowie was. And to be a Bowie fan, I can tell you the best thing about it, when he put out the album Let's Dance, totally a different direction. He went to a lot of dance music. It didn't bother him when disco came along. He just went to becoming the White Duke. And then where with some artists, I said, where do we go from here? But Bowie's always been a chameleon. The track where Elvis, I think what hurt Elvis when he went to Las Vegas and he started doing Las Vegas stuff. And some bands, and I think Las Vegas can make you a lot of money, but I think Las Vegas can hurt you too, because you're trapped in one area of music. So that's my opinion.
So it's more on the entertainment.
Yes.
Venue. You people spend their money to go sit and watch an entertainer, which is fine, but it's also like it's really, really interesting. I was thinking about that too. You're talking about the Las Vegas Elvis, and that some of the things you've said, John and David, were like Bowie had problems with substance abuse early in his career. Elvis had problems with it. It seems like, you know, it's always interesting to see how these people handle fame and how they handle all this, because you work so hard to get there, but what's it like when you get there? I mean, what makes you want to escape reality into, you know, drug abuse and alcohol abuse and all this other stuff? And I think that's also an interesting parallel between the two.
Yeah, I think of Elvis with the many people was sort of his own as far as an entourage. The problem with all his people around him, everybody wanted to be a yes man because they all depended on Elvis to have the wealth so that they could enjoy all the riches, and nobody would challenge him, would confront him. And, you know, I've read some things, if some people close to him would have actually confronted him, maybe he would have not fallen down the path that he was doing with all the different pills and, you know, the weight problem and so on. It was like, oh, Elvis, whatever you want to do, you're the man, Elvis, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And they, you're the king. That's what they would tell him. Where with Bowie, I think what hurt Bowie, the fame came when he got here, and I think it hit him so fast. And he said, here's this boy comes out of the Mercy area, and all of a sudden, you're doing these shows and stuff. You can only imagine that when you looked out there and have all this stuff, how each one handled it, but both of them had to overcome their own obstacles. And where Elvis, like John said, if one of them guys would have spoke up to Elvis and say, Elvis, you shouldn't do this, but they afraid he'd make him mad.
Yeah, and he wouldn't have him in the posse anymore. So.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, that's what it came down to. It's like, well, you know, I'm not gonna put myself out and on the road, you know. And
yeah, I want to ride that gravy train as long as I can. And well, I think that,
John, if I'd have been there, though, I'd have to join that posse, too, because he always had the hee-haw girls there.
and peanut butter and banana sandwiches and everything. I mean, it was like driving around in a Cadillac. I had to be pretty cool. But it's good points. This is a really interesting show, and I just want to thank you guys for being on, because I think tonight we've really hit on some great music, but also some great parallels in rock history.
Yeah, you know, I knew when we came up with putting Elvis with Bowie, people were like, what? But, you know, the more I studied it and thought about it, there are a lot of common threads in that they were pioneers in different ways. You know, earlier in the show, I was talking about the media in terms of TV and how Elvis brought rock and roll to TV. Bowie, in a sense, you could argue, gained his fame in what I call the dark era of rock on TV. But because he was so colorful, I think he was like the precursor to, like, we need to get some kind of an avenue to showcase his shows and what he's doing.
Yeah.
Led to MTV.
Wow.
Because, you know, in the 70s, they were making videos by the mid to late 70s, but when Bowie was doing this in the early 70s.
The scary monster video, John, where he does The Wizard of Oz with Major Tom. Yeah.
I mean, Bowie's music was made for video TV with the way he was just so colorful. So in a way, both of them were pioneers to different eras of how TV has either accepted or turned its back on rock and roll.
Well, John brought up one good point, John, too. John, remember Bowie's song Heroes never charted real well, but made him a lot of money on commercials after what happened on that famous day in 2001. Remember, they played Heroes for all things in New York,
yeah,
the fire department of New York, and that song just charted up again.
Wow. Well, guys, we're running out of time, and it's just been awesome. This has been a great show. So start thinking about the next one, what you guys want to do, and just throw some dates at me. And it's always so much fun to have you guys on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's always good talking to you, John.
Is there anything
you enjoy? Come up with a new topic, John, and get a chance to explore it and with you and. I know there's. I always hear from people. Sometimes a couple weeks later, they'll go back and hear it, and you know, they can catch it later. And they'll have questions or comments if they happen to see me. And just like you said, they can go on our website and write us emails too.
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
And I always tell them, under this mask, I'm only human.
what did you guys like to say to end the show about Presley and Bowie? David, what do you got?
My opinion on the two of them, they're always going to be, their music is never going to grow old because they were just icons. And when you're icons, your music never grows stale. And this great artist.
Yeah, that's a good point. John?
And my thought is the two are linked in many ways we showed tonight. So You can connect artists with Bowie. So forever, we're going to be linked with the 50s of rock and to the modern era as we move forward.
And those are good points. And the last two songs we're going to play tonight, we're going to play Are You Lonesome Tonight and Fame. And those kind of go together as what Elvis kind of, what he went through with his career and having all the people around, but he was kind of a lonely guy. And then we're going to the song Fame, which was about David Bowie's idea of what it was all about. So, guys, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Great show tonight. We'll do it again soon.
Well, you have a good evening, John.
Well, you guys too. And we're going to go out with Are You Lonesome Tonight? And everybody, I hope you're not lonesome tonight. And it's going to be a great 2012 on John Talk Radio and Timmons Rock. So stay tuned for all the great stuff coming up. And guys, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
John, thank you.
Are you lonesome tonight? Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart? Does your memory stray to a bright summer day when I kissed you and called you sweetheart? Do the chairs in your parlor seem empty and bare? Do you gaze at your doorstep and picture me there? Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight?
I wonder if you're lonesome tonight. You know, someone said that the world's a stage and each must play a part. Fate had me playing in love with you as my sweetheart. Act one was where we met. I loved you at first glance. You read your lines so cleverly and never missed a cue. Then came act two. You seemed to change. You acted strange. And why, I've never known. Honey, you lied when you said you loved me. And I had no cause to doubt you. But I'd rather go on hearing your lies than to go on living without you. Now the stage is bare, and I'm standing there with emptiness all around. And if you won't come back to me, then they can bring the curtain down. Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight?